Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for joining us. This week, a four-year project to better understand and prepare for future extreme weather and flooding events, and leadership change at the Mountain Association. First,
our queer clients are feeling a lot more fearful and feeling a lot more like the hate towards them and towards that group is given a certain kind of permission in society with the election result.
We are seeing an increase in suicidality and the language that we hear our young folks using around, you know, feeling hopeless, feeling defeated, feeling attacked. And so when we talk about safety, we are talking about both their mental and physical safety.
The Trevor Project estimated upwards of 700% increase in queer youth reaching out to them for support.
Dr. Joshua Turner, faculty coordinator for the Sexual Orientation, Gender Identity and Expression Clinic here at EKU, Ilana Rosenberg, executive director of the Louisville Youth Group, and Blake Blevins, a coordinator at the EKU Clinic. We asked them to share what they've been witnessing since a 2024 presidential election seen by many as possibly the most consequential of a lifetime. The votes have been cast and counted. Former President Donald Trump is returning to the White House, having promised during his campaign to enact policies and laws that would have a direct impact on lives. This week, a look at some consequences for neighbors, friends, and family, as well as some of the people you interact with as you go about your daily business, who identify with the LGBTQ community. What is this like for them and for those who care about them? And how can loved ones help them feel safe, secure, and welcome? Here's Dr. Turner.
Before, we had, of course, LGBT folks coming in, focused on wide range of issues, just living issues, right? After the election, the tone shifted quite a bit to feeling less able to navigate life and more fearful of what the next 4 years are going to look like. Much more focus on like fear of existing rather than focusing on the challenges of their personal lives.
There was already concern regarding discrimination and violence and bullying and rejection.
Blake Blevins.
Those issues already existed before this campaign. As a community, we've come a long way in our efforts in our fight for social justice and policy reform. However, the coast was never really clear for the queer community. It was never truly safe for us to come out. And now, for several, it feels as though we're back at square one.
And suddenly, questions. Dr. Turner.
What does it look like to modulate how you adapt to your environment? How do I change how I am showing up in maybe a situation where I don't feel very safe? And those are very real conversations that have to happen in order to keep people safe.
Blake Blevins.
The biggest highlighting component of all of that is trying to remind them of the work that they have put in, that they have come a long way since being diagnosed with that anxiety disorder or that trauma disorder, or grappling with that depression and that suicidal ideation. So just reminding them of that hard work that's already been put in by them. And who wants to see all of their hard work go to waste or, you know, recede? We don't want to see that. And so while they're coming in with the fears and the anxieties and the disappointment, but turn that around and also remind them just how strong they are.
I think that probably everybody can recognize that it takes strength to be yourself.
The Louisville Youth Group's Ilana Rosenberg.
Even if you are yourself in an environment that is telling you, we love you, we want you to be who you are, to really be yourself, there's something very, very vulnerable about that, right? So to do that in an environment that the messages, no matter, even when it's not as blatant as $215 million being spent on TV ads in a short period of months, the messaging is still very negative. The overall messaging is still very negative. And so you know that that person has to be even more brave.
I wish it didn't have to take so much courage, you know, just to exist and be who you are.
Dr. Joshua Turner.
The queer community has always been a place where courageous people live and people who are, you know, in the front lines of change and cultural shifts. that has always been true, and especially true of our trans brothers and sisters. And I think courage is kind of like has to be built in a little bit to to the identity of as a queer person in general, because it's an act of courage just to exist and to love who you love.
Transsexual people have been singled out on Capitol Hill in efforts to bar House members, officers, and employees from using single-sex restrooms in the Capitol or House office buildings that don't correspond with their biological sex.
I think there's just a lot of fear, which is interesting. I mean, trans people have always been around and have always been using public restrooms, so it's not really a different thing happening. But I think that there's a lot of uninformed and biased, prejudiced fear, right, that leads people to think that they're in harm's way if they're in a restroom with a trans person.
And here in Kentucky, Republican legislators have voted overwhelmingly to restrict the rights of trans people. Ilana Rosenberg.
When I am focusing on supporting our LGBT youth, they are the community that needs the most support. I think it is a question of, them feeling like they are already not supported within many of their communities, many of their environments. We passed legislation last year in this state that made it so that their teachers and their therapists and their doctors are not able to provide affirming care. They're not able to help the child identify the way that they do, affirm their identification, right? So that is insanely impactful for them. They are incredibly isolated because of it. And the statistic that I have seen was that there was more than $215 million spent on anti-trans TV commercials alone during these campaigns.
Blake Blevins, the EKU clinic coordinator.
Several of my clients are coming in with previous PTSD backgrounds and already walking around with lifelong anxiety disorders and trauma and, all of those things, depression, suicidal ideation, all of these different things that we see come up in a therapy session, those have been exacerbated following the recent presidential election. And I guess a lot of it really hovers around that identity piece. Like, what did we do wrong? Why are we the ones being targeted? Why are we being villainized? Why is society turning and on its own and sort of like attacking a particular set of individuals? I'm sure that there are more individuals that are being targeted, but that this is a community that I work with closely and I'm a part of, and I felt that and they are feeling that, and they're coming in and they want answers. Of course, I can't give them all of the answers. All we can really do is just hold space and allow them to process those different things that come up for them.
And Blevins is noticing a new trend among trans clients.
I have heard the common themes of, I know this place that can cure me. And just investigating that. What do you mean? What are you talking about? Cure for what? And they have simply just stated, like, being trans, like, they can cure me of being trans. And detransitioning, coming off of HRT, hormone replacement therapy, this is a part of that detransitioning process that's going to affect them physiologically. And not only that, but the amount of anxiety and trauma that comes from that, because there's a book that's titled The Body Keeps the Score, and it's about trauma. And so if our body keeps the score with not only the emotional and mental blows that we take, due to our identities and those different intersecting components of who we are, if our bodies can keep the score with those things, it can also keep the score with those physiological discrepancies and challenges as well.
So I asked Dr. Turner how he's counseling his clients.
I'm part of the queer community myself, and I feel like that has been something that's been helpful to me, to identify what is true for me, and regardless of how I may need to adapt to survive, because survivability, that adaptability, that courage is sort of built in to being in the queer community, and to some extent to being a human being, right? And I think one of the best things that can be self-empowering is to think about, okay, what are my truths? Let me make a list of the things that are true about me that I know to be who I am. That won't change regardless of political climate. Maybe I you know, can't always talk about them in the way that I want to or demonstrate them in the way that I want to, but that doesn't change the truth of them. And I think that that is the resiliency, tapping into that resiliency that every marginalized community has had to tap into many times before.
In the course of these conversations, I ask Alana Rosenberg if she can peg what it is about LGBTQ people that heterosexual people seem to fear.
I don't know what people are necessarily afraid of. It's hard to have that perspective from the other side of it, right? But we as humans tend to be afraid of difference. And our first response, whether that comes from our sort of primitive brain or whatever, is to separate difference and hold ourselves away from it. I think we are intelligent enough as a species to push past that, to recognize that difference is actually quite valuable in many ways for us and bring that into the practice of our life.
Same question for Blake Blevins.
Other than just simply it challenging everything they know and believe, there really isn't a lot to be afraid of. No one is saying that we're going to turn your kids queer or transgender, or no one is saying those things. We're just simply trying to create spaces and create a little bit of equity and equality across the board, no matter how you identify.
So let's say someone in your family, a loved one, or a good friend has just come out of the closet, and we realize that to keep our family or friendship together, we'll need to make some adjustments. What can we do?
Sit down and talk to a queer person. Sit down and talk to a trans person and allow them to tell you just how debilitating it has been on their journey, just existing in life, day to day, whether that be, you know, individuals that have experienced firsthand things like don't say gay laws and anti, you know, bathroom legislation and laws and different things like that. Just simply trying to exist in a space where people think that you shouldn't exist or they would eradicate you if they could. And hearing about those experiences and the trauma and the anxiety that comes along with experiencing those different things, I think would enlighten a lot of individuals. But I would say sit down and have a conversation with these people in your life.
It also means that you do some of that work, that you find out what you don't know and do some of the work yourself to find the answers.
When folks are in the closet, you know, they are, there's a lot of fear there, right? And a lot of concern about, am I still going to be accepted? And so they're looking for signs that that acceptance is going to be there. So if you're able to demonstrate that, whether you're directing it at that person or not, they're going to hear it and they're going to see it.
This segment was inspired by a recent incident in Lexington, a street attack on a gay person, some punches thrown. It was ugly. It appears to be an isolated incident. Police are investigating it as a hate crime.
As a city, we have zero tolerance for hate crimes or really, you can tag on to that any kind of crime, but hate crimes are no.
Lexington Mayor Linda Gordon.
Most people here have zero tolerance for hate crimes. I really think this. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in the seat I'm in.
In fact,
we are consistently, at least over the years I've been mayor, have been recognized by the Human Rights Campaign as a top city in the nation for equality and treatment based on equality. That's a good thing.
Lexington was recently again recognized by the Human Rights Campaign. It's a nationally acclaimed civil rights organization as a leader in lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender equality. In 2024, the city ranks 13th highest out of 506 municipalities across the country, sitting in the top 2.5%. Since 2021, Lexington has received the highest score of the evaluated cities in Kentucky.
I, as the leader of this community, am dedicated to this issue and fairness. I've believed in this for a long time. You know, I'm a registered nurse, Tom. Nurses are trained, if they already aren't in this space, to treat every patient with not only fairness, but to hear their story, to try to understand their story. And we don't change our care based on who somebody is, do we? We care for everyone through the lens of treating people fairly. Everybody deserves that. And, you know, in the end, none of us are going to be on this earth forever, right? And I think that when we die, I mean, this is kind of going deep into my philosophy, but I believe that the best thing someone could say about me when they're gathered for whatever it is to say goodbye is she treated people fairly. It's an awesome thing to be able to say that about someone.
In addition to a physical altercation, such as the incident under investigation in Lexington, there are other emergency needs, not only for the LGBTQ community, but for everyone. EKU's Dr. Joshua Turner.
If you're feeling in crisis and you really need mental health support, there is always 988. 988 is the same as 911. So 911, you're having a physical emergency, you need people to come to you. 988 is you're having a mental health emergency and you need to talk to someone right away.
If you or a loved one are in crisis, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK or 1-800-273-8255, or contact the crisis text line. You can text TALK, T-A-L-K, to 741-741. We know you might not be in a position to write that down, eyes on the road, so you can find it when you're in your home and a safe place to go online on our homepage at esweku.org. And for information on where to get other forms of care, try OutCare Health, one word, outcarehealth.org.
Which is a website that helps connect you to LGBT plus affirming providers. And that's all types of providers, whether it's physicians, you know, endocrinologists, mental health professionals. So it's a great resource to access if you're looking for someone that's safe, someone that you know is going to get it, someone that you know has some sort of training about how to be a queer affirming provider.
Meantime, what's the best thing you can do to be supportive of the LGBTQ people in your world?
The biggest and most important thing anyone can do as an ally is to listen and listen well, right? I think there's a difference between waiting for your turn to speak versus actually listening to what someone's telling you, right? And so I think that's one of the most important things for an ally is to listen to your queer friends and family, ask them questions about how they're feeling, ask them what they need. And one of the most powerful questions is, how can I support you best right now?
You've heard in this segment from Dr. Joshua Turner, faculty coordinator for the Sexual Orientation, Gender Identity and Expression Clinic here at EKU, Blake Blevins, a coordinator at the EKU Clinic, Ilana Rosenberg, executive director of the Louisville Youth Group, and Lexington Mayor Linda Gorton. Coming up after the break, a change in leadership at the Mountain Association, and a 4-year investigation gets underway into any connections between climate change, surface mining and development, and catastrophic flooding. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Leanne Potter with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts, the Kentucky Guild of Artists and Craftsmen will host the annual Holiday Open House and Gallery Hop, December 6th from 5:30 to 8 p.m. Events take place along Chestnut Street and the Artisan Village on North Broadway. More information is available at kentuckyguild.org. Lexington Children's Theater will present Elf the Musical Junior at the Lexington Opera House December 7th and 8th. Tickets are available at ltconstage.org. The University of Kentucky Opera Theater and winners of the All-Tech Vocal Scholarship Competition, along with the Uniting Voices Lexington Youth Choir, will perform in the Celebration of Song at All-Tech Arena in the Kentucky Horse Park on December 15th. More information is available at kyhorsepark.com. From the Kentucky Arts Council, for Eastern Standard, I'm Leanne Potter.
In October of last year, Peter Hilly announced that he would retire on May 1st of 2025 after 9 years as Mountain Association president. Peter joined the board in 2003, serving as treasurer and then board chair, before joining the Mountain Association staff in 2012 as executive vice president, then rising to president in 2015. This past June, it was announced that Robin Gabbard, who had been board chair since 2019, would succeed Peter. Robin has served as chief operating officer for LKLP Community Action. It's an agency that serves Leslie, Knott, Letcher, and Perry counties. and was also previously the Associate Executive Director of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Director of Teach for America Appalachia. So we wanted to wait just a bit while Peter and Robin got their sea legs and adjusted to these changes before we talked with them about this transition of leadership of an organization that has played such an important role in supporting the people of Eastern Kentucky. Peter and Robin, thanks so much for joining us here on Eastern Standard.
So good to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
You bet, Peter. And let's start with you. So much has happened in our region since 2015. What would you single out as the most important issues and the challenges confronting the region during your time in leadership at the Mountain Association?
Well, you know, Tom, one of the things that was such a big change when I joined the staff was the collapse of the thermal coal industry in 2012. And that had a tremendous impact on our communities and the people that we serve. But we also recognized that that was part of a very long 70-year slide of losing jobs in the coal industry starting in 1950 when the mines were mechanized. In fact, we'd already lost two-thirds of our coal mining jobs by the time we hit that big collapse in 2012. So our work has really focused on how we can help the communities in our region recreate themselves as places where people can live and will choose to live. And everything we've done has been focused on that. Now, obviously, we hit a couple of bumps along the way, one of those being the pandemic, which no one had ever experienced anything like before. And then, of course, in 2022, when we had the disastrous flooding in Eastern Kentucky. But throughout all of those experiences, our clarity of purpose has really helped us keep moving forward as an organization, even as we had to learn to do things in very different ways.
Well, when you look back on those two decades with the Mountain Association, which transitioned on your watch from what had been known for years as the Mountain Association for Community and Economic Development, or as we all called it, MACED, what do you consider to be the most important accomplishment?
Well, you know, when I think about that, I think about both internal and external things. And you mentioned our name change. That was really part of a much bigger process that we've gone through internally over the last several years of asking questions about equity. And part of that name change was realizing that the obscurity of our name, MACED, most people didn't know what it meant, created a barrier and made us a little bit less accessible to people, which is why we changed it just using the first part of that Mountain Association, because it tells where we work in the mountains and it tells how we work by association with a lot of partners and allies. But we've also, in that time, we have grown in a lot of ways. We have almost doubled the size of our loan portfolio. We now have over $20 million invested in small businesses all over Eastern Kentucky. And we have grown our energy sector work substantially. We have now a large body of work in clean energy, which started mostly with energy efficiency, but in recent years has tremendously expanded in solar energy with small businesses. So, for example, the Isom IGA store in Isom, Kentucky, that grocery store was one of the hardest hit in the floods of 2022. Mm-hmm. We had done extensive work with them on energy efficiency and then adding solar. In fact, the solar panels on the roof were one of the few things that were not taken out by that flood, and they continued to generate electricity throughout the time they were rebuilding. And now they've reopened the store, and it only took them about 9 months to do that. But the store looks great. Those solar panels are still contributing to their energy savings, as well as the upgraded HVAC and cooling fixtures inside. They're now saving $70,000 a year. And for a grocery store, that can make the difference between being able to keep the doors open in a place that would otherwise be a food desert.
Yeah, it's really significant. Well, let's bring Robin into the conversation. Robin, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've been active for many years and working to improve lives in Eastern Kentucky. So what from those experiences are you now applying to this new role as Mountain Association leader?
I think what we've learned over the years is that it takes a reinvestment of time, talent, and treasure on all of our parts across the region to not only think about what an economy looks like post-coal, or post anything, any post any mono economy, but post coal as it relates to Eastern Kentucky, and what that development can do for communities. It builds confidence in ourselves. It builds strength in the businesses and local leaders to make decisions that are based and rooted in community rather than being based in always reaching outside or having someone push money in toward us. It also it boosts a regeneration of the economy. It keeps money moving and stirring and flowing within the economy, which makes everything, each community, regardless of which one we're talking about, it makes them a better place to live. And so as I have, I'm an Eastern Kentucky girl, so as I have watched what it means for us to boom and bust and boom and bust and really dig our heels in every single time after the fact, to be working in that space and see communities really embrace a reinvestment of themselves and really begin planning for the future has just been a true anchor for me in my work and something that I'm bringing to the role.
Well, speaking of the flow of funds, the Environmental Protection Agency, as part of its Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, recently rolled out this new $500 million initiative. It's called the Green Bank for Rural America. Will the Mountain Association and its client communities benefit from that?
Absolutely, we will. And how impressive it is for us to be able to be seen as a real expert in the field and to be able to deploy these funds across the region, not only creating energy efficient opportunities for business owners and communities, but also just being able to be an advocate for a stronger climate and being seen as an organization that can safely and effectively and ethically deploy these funds, that's a win.
In a practical sense, how do you see those funds being applied? How do they become real?
Well, Peter was talking earlier about the grocery store, one of the grocery stores that we work with.
Right.
And so we hope to continue sharing that news with other small business owners, small to mid-sized business owners, and showing them how they can really enjoy the cost savings that are there, but then reinvest into their employees, their business, their community. We're also thinking about what it looks like to reinvest in a community in general. Mountain Association owns a building in Hazard, Kentucky. We've been deeply involved in the downtown redevelopment in Hazard. And so what does it look like to be able to bring those funds into facilities and create a stronger carbon neutral experience or create resiliency hubs? And Peter, what else would you want to add to that?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, Robin. And, you know, it's one of the things about the clean energy space. There is obviously a lot of focus on the climate imperative, and we totally understand the need for that. But when we talk to businesses, we're usually talking about this as a way that you can save money. This is a way you can make your business more profitable. You know, those grocery stores have such razor-thin margins that if they can save a dollar on their electric bill, it's like selling another $30 worth of groceries. Now, if you're at a rural crossroads in Letcher County, as the ISM IGA is, selling hundreds of thousands of dollars more in groceries is unlikely, but saving $70,000 a year through energy efficiency and solar is absolutely doable. And these projects, these grocery retrofits, may cost $500,000 or more to do. So we will be eligible to apply for $10 million through the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund program. It's called the Community Accelerator Initiative, and we will be applying that money in loans to these local businesses to help them save that money. We recently visited the hardware store in Pineville, Kentucky, where we had helped them with an energy retrofit and solar on the roof. And they showed us their utility bills from 4 years ago. Their utility bill for August was about $950. And this past August, it was less than $50.
Wow.
that's real money.
Yeah,
that's real money.
A small business in a small town.
Yeah, it's real money. And he has 57 employees and is able to continue being an anchor in his own community and reducing that burden on those customers who may have to go somewhere else.
You know, the energy transition that we're talking about here really figures into the next question I want to ask you all, and that's about narrative change, which has been an important thing to all of us for so long now. What does narrative change mean to you, and how should we be telling the world about Appalachian Kentucky in the 21st century?
You know, it's a great question, Tom. And one of the things that we like to bring into the discussion is that it's very hard to come up with the right solution if you've got the wrong analysis of the problem. There are a lot of people who propose solutions for places like Eastern Kentucky, and there are energy communities all over the nation in which this is very much the case. What happens with an energy extraction economy is first the resources extracted, the coal's hauled out literally, but the profits are extracted also in that, because usually the investment came from outside and the return on investment goes back to the outside. What's sometimes missed in that set of transactions is at the end of the process, the workforce is extracted. And that's what's happened in Eastern Kentucky, where so many of our communities over the course of 50, 75 years have lost half their population. So when we think about the hardware store and the grocery store and the coffee shop and the bookstore and the local farmer's market and the local foods grocery store, all those are things that are changing the quality of life in the community. And so we think when the analysis gets over-focused on how do we replace the coal mining jobs that were lost in 2012, we have to say first, those miners that lost their jobs in 2012, the majority of them, the vast majority, have left. Harlan County lost 1,500 coal mining jobs. They lost 2,500 in population. It's a direct correlation. And people say, well, you know, a job working in a coffee shop, that doesn't replace a job as a coal miner. And that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to lift that up from the transactional assessment and say, what we're trying to do is recreate a quality of life that makes it possible for the young person who's growing up in the community to say, I think I want to stay, or the young person who left to go to college to say, I want to come back, or somebody who left 30 years ago in one of those boom and bust cycles that Robin talked about, and they found that good job somewhere else, and now they're ready to retire with all that money in their 401k, and they'd love to come back home if we have the quality of life and the amenities and the services that they're going to need, and that's healthcare, and it's housing, and it's the coffee shop and the bookstore and all these other things. So it's really about a systems approach that says we're helping communities transform themselves. And we are, in fact, seeing the fruit of long, long work that is now beginning to be evident in our communities. Bill Eastep wrote an article in the Herald Leader last year about all these downtowns that are coming back to life, the storefronts that are full that 10 years ago were empty. In Robin's community, between 2010 and 2020, the population increased 18% after being in decline for decades.
And Tom, it's impossible for us to not be talking about the changes in relation to the climate for those of us who lived through the 2022 flood. My home community was devastated. My school, Buckhorn School, which is a K-12 K-12 school in the Perry County school system, was destroyed, and the students had to be transported to Hazard for 2 years, and they've just gotten back in that building this year after a $15 million renovation. So it's impossible for us to not be talking about the effects of climate change, accepting those these days, and helping our communities better prepare themselves for the next time that happens. And so in order to do that, you have to talk about it. You have to have a narrative change. You have to think about things differently.
How do you think that conversation is being received now? So, you know, a few years ago, not all that well. Has that changed?
Agreed. I think that what we have seen across the board over the last 10 years after the final decline is that people are beginning to not only realize, but recognize and talk about real changes to our environments. And if they weren't publicly talking about that before the flood, we are definitely now talking about it.
Yeah, I guess we've had so many enormous events happen since then, including the 22 flood, but then Helene in North Carolina, and so on and so forth. So it's pretty clear.
As I have said to many of my neighbors and my community leaders, what we experienced was catastrophic. But to now see that that was minuscule in comparison to what our neighbors have experienced is far more catastrophic than what we endured.
Well, you know, my next interview is going to be with Chris Barton, the University of Kentucky hydrologist, and he is leading off a team who are going to be investigating how to better prepare our communities for just that kind of event. So I'm looking forward to dovetail into that conversation. But I wanted to wrap this up with you all by asking each of you, what strengths and assets should we be recognizing and nurturing as a means of building up our economic prosperity in Eastern Kentucky? What do we have that's working for us that we need to really think about and take care of?
You know, as an organization that works with small businesses and entrepreneurs, we have the wonderful opportunity to work with many, many talented and energetic entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs throughout Eastern Kentucky. People with good ideas, good opportunities to grow things in their community, and they just need that additional support. Sometimes that is training and technical assistance, and sometimes that is just straight up the financing that we can provide to small businesses, whether that's a startup entrepreneur or a small business that's been operating and is poised to grow. But I think it's these locally owned businesses that are the fundamental building blocks of helping our communities recreate themselves as livable places. And it's all those small businesses together that make that work. And there's no shortage of good ideas, and there's no shortage of entrepreneurs out there. And I think that's why we're seeing some of the positive trends that we're seeing in our communities.
And you, Robin?
I think the other thing that we need is good open conversations so that people understand what resources are available to them. And not that we haven't been doing that over the years, but I think that the Mountain Association is poised to be creating more opportunities for us to be sharing with not only entrepreneurs, but our business leaders across the region and our state leaders and federal leaders. We show up in a lot of spaces and being able to bring the information, the resources, for not only development, but growth to the region is a huge asset.
Well, Peter, thinking past May of next year, what's next for you?
Well, I'm going to be 70 years old in May, and I'm saying, for starters, I'm going to spend more time with my granddaughter. And my wife and I have got some travel planned. I've got a new-to-me used fishing boat that I want to spend a little more time in. I've got a ton of projects to finish at home. But there are ways that I would love to keep a toe in the water of this work. This is work has been my life's passion for 35 years, and I would hope that I can find some ways to continue to contribute to it here and beyond.
All right. And Robin, what's on your plate for the immediate future?
Mountain Association is about to roll out a new strategic plan. And we're just looking forward to diving deeper into the work that Peter and others have championed for a long, long time.
Okay, when that rollout occurs, I hope we can come back and talk about it.
Absolutely, we would love to.
Fantastic. Peter Hilly, retiring as president of the Mountain Association, his successor, Robin Gabbard, thank you both for joining us here on Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Parts of Eastern Kentucky are still recovering from the terrible flooding of late July 2022, and an important part of that recovery is to better understand what happened in order to be better prepared for future extreme weather and flooding events. University of Kentucky hydrologist Chris Barton is leading the quest for that deeper understanding as principal investigator of a four-year project titled The Flooding in Appalachian Streams and Headwaters Initiative, Mitigating Impacts of Climate Change and Flash Flooding in Appalachia. Project partners include civil engineers, environmental scientists, and social scientists from UK, University of Louisville, Eastern Kentucky University, West Virginia University, and Marshall University. It's supported by a $1 million award from the U.S. National Science Foundation. Chris Barton, welcome back to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
So with this study, what are you looking to learn?
Well, first of all, we're trying to answer some questions that came up after the 2022 flood. There was a lot of concern about climate change and how that was driving these catastrophic floods. And we want to look at the long-term data set that we have at Robinson Forest in Breathitt, Perry, and Knott County, Kentucky, where we have over 50 years of hydrology data from, a representative area of Central Appalachia. We also had a lot of questions about what was the effect of land use on this flooding. Did the mining have something to do with it? Did development have something to do with it? And these are things that we really want to, take a deep dive and learn more information about so that we can better predict when these type of events are going to happen. And also to, maybe develop some systems, some technologies where we can do a little better job of early detection of these type of floods.
Any early idea of those technologies, what they might look like?
Yeah, well, we're working with the U.S. Geological Survey on a simple trail camera or a wildlife camera that we can take pictures of the stream when it's coming up and going down in response to a rain event. And if we have, many hundreds of events that we can correlate to our actual calibrated equipment in Robinson Forest, we can use AI and machine learning to actually develop predictive models on how these, streams will respond to different types of rain events. So that's one that's hopefully a low-cost method that we can share with communities, and, they could put them out and, be able to be more prepared for these types of storms.
Thinking back to what happened in July of 22, that came on so suddenly. It was pretty difficult to predict that it would be as rapid and as powerful as it actually was. Are you kind of taking that kind of thing into your thinking about this?
Yeah, well, part of the study is to look at how climate change is affecting these types of events. And we saw it just recently in North Carolina. That was a tropical event, but those two events had something very much in common. If you remember back in 2022, we were experiencing some of the hottest temperatures on record in the southwestern United States. And similarly, a month ago or 2 months ago, in the Gulf of Mexico, we had some of the highest recorded water temperatures there. And what both of these, events happened was you really heated up that atmosphere to levels that we really haven't seen before. And that heated atmosphere can hold a lot of additional water from all of the evaporation and transpiration and water coming from the soil. And as those air masses move north and lift as they come into the mountains, the air cools and all that water comes out. And so we feel like we're going to see these types of, extreme events happen more and more as our global temperature continues to rise.
So I guess what in past years might have been thought of as a Gulf event a coastal event now becomes more inland.
Yeah. So, that's exactly what we're seeing is just the air temperatures are so high that they can become saturated with even more water. And unfortunately, that water's got to come down somewhere, and it takes that lifting and that cooling of the air mass for this to happen.
Now, will you also be looking at landscape alterations, things like mountaintop removal and how they affect flash flooding?
Yeah, and that was a big thing that came up in the 2022 flood was what was the effect of mining on exacerbating this type of flooding. And I had, I really didn't know because that landscape is engineered. It's engineered to handle water. And so there really wasn't, I couldn't point to anything in particular to say, yes, it did, other than the fact that many of these sites aren't reforested. And we do know from our research that putting the forest back on these mine landscapes will actually help mitigate some of the flooding, because the trees are actually utilizing the water. And also there's some other things that happen on the sites that the forest can actually help mitigate some of that flooding.
I read that the project includes helping high school and middle school teachers develop programming. And of course, that is a tacit look at the future and developing people in the future who understand this better. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So one of the things we really want to do with this project is there's definitely a physical science part of it, but we also want, you know, to have community input and a social side of it as well. And we really thought that, you know, especially with the whole concept of climate change, it's a lot easier to convince young people that, you know, things are actually changing. And so we want to work with these communities and help them, you know, be part of the solution is really what it's all about, and engage middle school kids and engage high school students and develop programs on having them actually going out and doing the monitoring and coming up with, you know, the detection of these early response systems.
So this is just now getting underway, is that right?
We literally got the funding in September, and okay. So several of us are meeting tomorrow, actually, in Eastern Kentucky. We're going to go to Lily Cornett Woods and in Perry County, as well as Robinson Forest, and start, you know, instrumenting some of these watersheds.
Well, you know, I recall right after the flood, discussions about how this needed to happen. We needed to really understand what's going on. It sounds to me as though that's where this is headed.
It really is. And doing it as a regional type of effort, too, makes a lot of sense, because, you know, the folks in West Virginia have experienced a lot of flooding in the last couple of years, similarly to what we experienced in 2022. And bringing together engineers and people like me and social scientists and extension agents really makes it a very broad sort of project, where we hopefully can not only come up with the answers of what's causing all of this to happen, but coming up with some solutions that we can provide to the communities and hopefully, you know, make the place better to live in.
Okay. Can we book you for 2028 to give us a result of all that?
Absolutely. Yes.
All right, you're on. University of Kentucky hydrologist Chris Barton, principal investigator of a four-year project titled The Flooding of Appalachian Streams and Headwaters Initiative, Mitigating Impacts of Climate Change and Flash Flooding in Appalachia. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome.
You might recall that in the days and weeks following the 2022 flood in Eastern Kentucky, a lot of people got on board with the realization that there's real reason to try to get ahead of disasters with some planning, building, and training. Matt Garland, Vice President of Operations at Appalachia Service Project, is with us. They've received a $10 million grant from the Appalachian Regional Commission to develop a natural disaster recovery and home rebuilding network in the region. And so, obviously, we want to know more about that. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Matt.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So, if I'm correct about this, this grant money comes through ARISE, which is the acronym for Appalachian Regional Initiative for Stronger Economies. How will you use the funding?
So, this funding is actually through the Appalachian Regional Commission, or ARC, through their ARISE program that you mentioned, the $10 million. What we're seeking to do is to ensure capacity building, long-term sustainability, and localized resiliency through a couple of different methods. And that is to establish three community-based affordable housing and long-term disaster recovery centers across Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia. And then we want to enhance the area's workforce ecosystem and employment support system by increasing affordable home construction operations through new build and home repair programs.
And in the introduction, was I right about that? Is this in part about getting ahead of the curve? Because we seem to be experiencing more of these, you know, extreme weather events, and we were kind of caught unawares in 2022.
Yes. So part of this is to encourage that growth and that mindset change of being prepared for these disasters as they come about. A lot of time when a disaster strikes, there's not a rapid recovery system that's put in place in communities because we're not generally prepared for that. So what ASP hopes to do is to educate and coordinate through our partners and communities to help assist them so that if and when disaster does strike, that they're adequately prepared to deploy systems to the community to help them recover and rebuild.
I guess this grant was just recently received, right? So I'm wondering, you know, is planning underway now? Any specific projects in the pipeline?
Yes, we're currently taking applications through www.asphome.org that you can coordinate with our team. Right now, we have deployed our East Tennessee hub, which is working in new build and disaster relief. So our team is on the ground in several counties in Tennessee, and we're coordinating efforts with North Carolina as well. So yeah, the grant was awarded. We got notice of it late last month. Obviously, the disaster occurred in the middle of the month. And so we are rapidly deploying those funds out into the communities just as soon as we can.
Now, these state disaster and recovery hubs will also go up in Virginia and here in Kentucky, if I understand that correctly. And I'm just wondering how do they function as a network? Is there communication going on among them and lessons learned, shared, that kind of thing?
So as we build these out, yes, there will be similarities for all three of the hubs that we're implementing in the states. So it'll be a cohesive unit headquartered here in Johnson City, but there will be locations, physical locations in Kentucky and Virginia as well to help sustain those efforts on the ground. So we'll have boots on the ground and a physical presence in those areas to assist with any needs.
Now, I understand that these hubs will also offer some training of first responders and community organizations on disaster mitigation and response best practices. Is that a correct understanding? And can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that's part of the $10 million funding that we received to help coordinate that and develop that curriculum so that we can implement that in the communities on a case-by-case basis. So what the community needs is what we're prepared to put together to assist in disaster relief and rapid rebuild. So as we continue to roll those out, the period for this grant actually, it runs over a 60-month or a five-year period. So as we implement these into these areas, you'll see that curriculum evolve, and then we'll begin the training and the community awareness portion of it.
All right, that's Matt Garland, Vice President of Operations at the Appalachia Service Project in Johnson City. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org. You can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app and podcast versions, on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. And remember, live a good, honorable life, and then when you get older and think back, you'll enjoy it a second time. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.